Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
Are you someone who mostly gets your way, say a family discussion, say about where to go for holidays or where to hang a painting? Does your suggestion get the green light? And deprivedly you think, yes, I talked them round. Or are you often giving in to someone who's more persuasive in your family? What about at work? Does your voice get heard in meetings? Is it your idea or project that gets up, or are you always doing somebody else's stuff? Do you constantly feel compromised, or worse, just told, no, not a good idea, forget it? The skills of persuasion, designed to help you get what you want, are required in just about every aspect of life. Partners, parents, children, neighbours, friends, work colleagues, tiny things and other times too big things. Persuasion, though, is both a science and an art, and tonight we're going to find out why. I wonder whether you're good at getting people to say yes to you. 1-300-800-222 is the number. And have you ever been surprised when someone says, yeah, that's a good idea? Did you say, oh, really? No one's ever said that before. Michelle Bowden's been teaching the skills of persuasion for over two decades. She's the author of How to Persuade, The Skills You Need to Get What You Want. And she joins us here in the studio this evening. Michelle, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
So great to be here, Philip.
We took no persuading for you to come on.
No, none at all. It's an honour to talk to you. You're a legend.
You say you've pitched and persuaded your way to everything in life.
Yeah, I think so.
You've got husband, kids, house, thriving business, and now you've written a book.
Yes, yeah, second book.
Really? And that's all due to persuasion?
Yeah, I think
Did you have to persuade the husband? That doesn't reflect well on you. Well,
I did.
That doesn't reflect well on you.
I think all relationships, there's a bit of persuasion there in the end, isn't there?
Do you think? Talk to me about that.
You should date me. I'm gorgeous.
Really?
Isn't that what you said?
I don't know in relationships. Is that about persuading people?
I think it is. I think everything that you want and need is on the other side of persuasion. And actually, I think because we don't talk about persuasion at school, we don't learn it as a skill at school, we don't really think of it as a thing in our life. You know, we go into a conversation or a meeting, a relationship, and we just act how we've always acted, and we leave the interaction and we get on with the next interaction, and we don't think, oh, well, that was a persuasive moment. And therefore, we don't think we should be doing anything in particular to persuade.
Yeah, we recognise it, though. Well, I mean, maybe we should talk about what persuasion is and what it isn't.
Yeah.
Because we recognise it, don't we? When we hear somebody say something that makes us think again or maybe even changes our mind, I mean, we know what that is. We know what it feels like, don't we?
Yeah,
you're saying we don't think about how to do it ourselves.
No, I don't think we do. And I also don't think we realise when we're in a persuasive moment, because you cannot not influence. We're always influencing. We're always persuading. And to your point about what is persuasion, I think persuasion is where there's a measure of freedom in the decision-making process of that stakeholder. So they don't feel that you force them or coerce them or push them into doing something that they didn't really want to do. No one likes to feel guilty at the end of the day for the way we interacted with the people around us. And so I think persuasion is where everybody leaves the interaction and feels good. And it's like you've used your superpowers, and they feel that the thing you wanted them to do was the right thing for them. They feel good about that.
Well, that's when it ends up well. I mean, but sometimes people can be persuaded. Let me put this to you. I mean, is persuasion really just the nicer end of manipulation?
Yeah, it is. So the little bit of science for you quickly. So influence is the set of, is really the discipline. And then there are five main ways that we go about influencing the people around us. Two of the ways are aggressive, that's forcing and directing. Two of the ways are passive, that's modelling and guiding. And the assertive approach is persuasion, that's the middle approach to influence. So it's not possible to be simultaneously persuasive and manipulative. because if you're being manipulative, you've moved either into that aggressive or that passive approach to influence.
Yeah. I wonder whether or not, if we're talking about persuasion, you say we do it all the time. We're always trying to persuade people.
Well, not trying to, but I think we just do.
We do.
So I'll give you a quick example. The other day I wore a flower in my hair to work. And I was running a training course for a whole heap of other trainers in a large corporation. And it's possibly, many of your listeners would agree, it's not possibly the most fashionable statement to wear a flower in your hair, but it's something I like to do and it makes me feel good. Well, about 2 weeks later, I found out that every single one of those trainers was now wearing flowers in their hair. Now, I promise there was no moment where I talked about flowers in the hair in that training course, but they just, it's what we call modelling. You can't not influence. People saw me, they liked whatever they saw, and then they decided to model even just a silly little thing like that, a flower in their hair. Mm. So we are influencing even when we don't realise. It's not that we're trying to persuade all the time, but we just are.
Yeah. Ian from Chatswood asks a good question. He says, what's the boundary between persuasiveness and selfishness? Because after all, if you're just trying to persuade people to your point of view all the time, you're not really listening to anybody, are you? You're just thinking, how can I maximise my own wants and desires here?
I think that is manipulation, what you've just described there, Philip. So if it's persuasion, it's not you being selfish. It's you thinking about your intent. So what is your intent here? Thinking about the other person and what is best for them in the context of what you want. So if you're trying to persuade them to do something that is just not good for them, then that has to be manipulation. That can't be persuasion. There are some arguments we shouldn't win.
Yeah, but okay. Sometimes, though, we could have a discussion about listening skills, for example.
Sure.
I mean, if I'm listening to someone, I'm not trying to persuade them, am I?
No.
I'm just listening to them.
That's it. And persuasive people listen well.
Do they?
Yeah. Persuasive people listen not with the intent to
Aren't
reply.
Aren't they inherently selfish people?
No. That's the manipulators, Philip. So persuasive people who are good listeners listen with the intent not to reply, but to actually hear what the person said and make sense of it. Yeah.
1-300-800-222 is my number. You can text me on 0467-922-702. We're talking about persuasion. Now, Michelle Bowden, our guest, is very strong on this idea that persuasion is not manipulation.
That's it.
Persuasion is about everyone thinking and feeling like they're winning. This is kind of the gold standard, isn't it?
The gold standard.
Everyone says, look, the best persuaders arrive at a situation where everyone in the room thinks it was their idea.
Yeah. And feels good about it.
What about the idea, though, of the persuader who comes up with a great idea? For example, I don't know, there might be a marketing idea at work, might be a way to solve a playground problem at school, could be a way to deal with a difficult colleague, that someone says, I think we should do this. Is that the best way to start?
No.
because I've thought about it more than anybody else in the room, and I have got the answer. I think I've got the answer here.
I think they might be right. You know, we're all persuaded differently. This is the important thing when we're talking about persuasion. We're all persuaded differently. There are four main approaches to persuasion. There are these things that are called persuasion indicators, and these are essentially questions that we each as humans need to have addressed in our own mind if we are to be persuaded by the other person. So some of us really need for the argument to be logical, for there to be external proof, and for there to be a solid rationale behind the idea. Then there are other people who need the communicator, the persuader, to be the expert. They need to be trustworthy and believable. Then there are people who need to have goodwill and rapport and a connection between the two parties in order to be persuaded. And then there are people that need to be swept up in your enthusiasm and passion for the matter. So that person who's come up with a good idea, who says, I think we should do it this way. This is my great idea. That person's what we call a commanding eagle. They're the one that is the expert in the room, and sometimes they're right. Sometimes their idea is the right idea. And if they've been able to convey their idea in a way that gives everybody else a strong sense that this person's got the runs on the board and they are to be followed, then they might well be persuasive in that moment. They might get their idea across. But if the audience or the people that need to be persuaded have a different need than the persuader, there's going to be a disconnect. Does that make sense? So
that's a command control sort of type of persuasion, that you've got someone in the room who said, look, I once led a big sales campaign. We were selling a very similar product to this.
I can tell
you all the mistakes we made.
This is
the best way to do it. What you've got to do is get rid of that, that and that and do this, this and this. Trust me.
Yes.
I know this area.
Yep.
I really have been here before.
That's it.
If you follow me, please, everything's going to be all right.
That's it. And there are people who will follow that kind of persuasive approach because that's all they need is for the person that is doing the persuading to be credible in that way.
We all want that in a way, don't we? Don't we all secretly actually want to fall in behind someone who we trust and we think they're benign and benevolent dictators?
Look, we are all influenced differently and we all have a different combination of those four needs. So
Did we do the other? So hang on. So there's the credibility, wisdom, well-researched, logical argument.
Yeah, that's called the wise owl.
Right. Then there's the command control. I've done this before. Just trust me.
I'm not too excited about calling it command control, can I just say?
Okay.
I just think this person is very confident and self-assured and charismatic.
Yeah.
What
are the other two?
Other than command control. Then there's the friendly budgie. That's the person that really needs the goodwill and the rapport and the connection. That famous saying from Theodore Roosevelt, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
Yeah.
And then there's the captivating peacock, and the captivating peacock is the one that wants to sweep everyone up with their enthusiasm and passion. So the thing that's funny.
This is so exciting, guys.
Yeah.
You've got to join me. This is going to be great.
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly it. And the hilarious thing here is that we're not trying to persuade ourselves. What we mostly do as humans is use the style that works on us when we're persuading the other person, when actually what we should be doing is reading what the other person needs and using the approach that would best persuade them.
All right, there are four main types of persuading personalities, right? The one is what you've called the owl, which is
the wise owl.
People who say, "Look, let's just look at the facts here."
That's it.
And this is the research.
That's it.
And you know, if you go through the research, as you can see, we can't do that because we don't have either the money, the people, or the expertise.
That's it. The facts speak for themselves.
So we can't do that. So we've got two other courses left and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
That's it.
The eagle says, don't worry about it. I've done it before. I know how to do it. Trust me. The budgie says, hey, guys, this is just going to be great together. Why don't we all just get together?
And it's really easy.
Is the budgie... Budgies are annoying. Hang on.
Yeah, that's it. I was going to say it's really easy to make it sound like budgies are airheads and that they've got no redeeming qualities. That's not the case. They're very high in emotional intelligence. So they're really good at understanding what the other person needs in an interaction. They are the listeners. They are the people that make you feel good. They remember your name. They remember key details about you. They know what's best for you. They wouldn't manipulate you. They just really care.
Just back on this manipulation persuasion issue, though, which I'm struggling a bit with it.
Okay.
Because in essence, to be a great persuader, you've got to be a person of strong opinion, don't you? Because after all, if you don't have a strong opinion, you've got nothing to go into fight for. So really is the great persuader the person with the strongest opinions in the room, but they just manage to find ways to hide that?
My perception of this is that it's not about the person with the strongest idea. Sometimes it's the person with the best idea. And their natural style isn't to be forceful about the way they convey it. Their natural style is to slowly but surely bring people around to their way of thinking. Maybe they structure their message better. But there's a sense of care and concern for the other party.
Yeah, but you can't persuade people unless you have an opinion, unless you have a deep and abiding opinion, can you? Because you've got to believe in your own position, don't you?
Well, one of the mistakes that most people make in persuasion is that they're not passionate enough about their idea. So as my sassy 23-year-old daughter says to me, "Mum, moods are contagious. Is yours worth catching?" And she's right. She's sassy, but she's right, that if you're not excited by the idea, then it's going to be very difficult to get somebody else to buy into it. So you do have to believe in the thing that you're trying to persuade about.
My texter says, Ian from Bradley says, "Richard Branson was known as one of the best persuaders. I've read that he'll do a deal, and you walk away thinking this is the best deal ever. And yet, of course, he's gained the most from the deal." Is that the key? Is that a key thing from persuasion, that you get the most of your position out of it?
Not necessarily. And in that example, I think Ian, the texter, has hit it right on the head, that the person says after they leave Richard Branson, "That's the best deal ever. I feel so good about this." So in my definition, that is persuasion. The person is happy. Good on Richard Branson if he got the best part of the deal, but the person who he was persuading feels terrific. You can't ask for anything more than that out of an interaction, can you? As long as you don't get that buyer's remorse after. And now I think you've slipped back into what I call manipulation. So if that person left the Richard Branson interaction thinking, "Oh, amazing, amazing," and then a week later goes, "Oh, that was rubbish, and now I feel like I was used," then no, that's not persuasion. And that's not what I wrote a book about.
What happens in a room where you feel as though the room is on the wrong track? And, you know, you have got some experience in this, and you feel as though the room's on the wrong track. What they're thinking of doing here will not achieve what they want, but they won't be persuaded. What's the best technique here to move on?
So there's never going to be a best technique when it comes to persuasion, because we're all persuaded differently. And so actually, for each of those four persuasive types, there are 10 actions that you need to get super good at. And within the 10 actions, there's a whole heap of subsets. So I'm sure your listeners are thinking, "Oh my God, that all sounds like way too much hard work." But as someone once said to me, "I'd rather know what the 40 actions are and put my effort into bringing those things in as my habit than wasting time trying to improve skills that aren't actually helpful to me." So some of the 40 actions are really easy things, like you've got to do better eye contact, remember people's names, laugh more, smile more. But some of the things are a lot more complicated. And when you are keen to persuade, the whole, like to use your example, the whole room is not being persuaded by you, but you know best and you think that this is just really wrong, then there's effort that needs to go into that moment. There needs to be some analysis of what's happening, what are the stakeholders thinking, feeling and doing, what do I want them to be thinking, feeling and doing, and then working out what's the best way to structure that argument so that whoever those people are moved. There's a current to desired state shift is what we're aiming for here.
All right, we're talking about persuasion. Michelle Bowden's been teaching the skills of persuasion for 2 decades, and she's the author of How to Persuade, the skills you need to get what you want. Paul from Perth's on the line. Hi, Paul.
Hello, how are you?
Not bad.
Now, look, I'm a building manager, and I work in the strata title body corporate industry, where you have to do a lot of persuading to get a small group of people voluntarily working in order to come about sometimes extremely difficult decisions. Now, I'd like to emphasise that one approach I work on is to work out the needs of the people as opposed to the wants of the people.
What do you mean by that?
Insofar, a person might say, if you try to sell them something, "I want this." And you listen very, very carefully to what they say, but then you perhaps suggest to them, "Yes, I understand what you want. But have you ever thought about this particular need, which is a little bit different to your want, and maybe is more important at this point in time?" Now, if you could tap into their thinking as to what they really need as opposed to what they want, you're halfway there getting them to come on your side. Now, I could give examples of this, but...
Give us an example, Paul.
In the body corporate industry, it's extremely difficult, as anybody knows who works in this industry. I've got a struggle there. Can I just set that aside as an example and go on to our problem? Our problem is you always get a group of people where you will get 70, 80% working along the lines of decision-making that you've been speaking about. And I want to thank you for this topic. It's fantastic. But how do you handle people of low emotional intelligence, ignorance, and driven by self, who are ignorant and driven by self-interest? They can be extremely disruptive. And you can stand on your head, you can whistle, you can shout, and others can do the same. And in the end, you just don't know what to do. It's like building a head against a brick wall. How do you handle them?
I can hear your pain, Paul. I hear you. It feels like you're banging your head against a brick wall. And that's why I came up with these four persuasive types, because you appreciate that if the communication scenario requires what is currently your strength, Paul, then you'll just talk. The people will listen. They'll agree with what you're saying. And then they'll get on with it and they'll do exactly what you hoped. Feels amazing. Doesn't feel like a persuasive moment at all. Just feels like you were chatting and it was no big deal. If, on the other hand, the persuasive moment requires what is currently your persuasive weakness, you don't have the skills in your communication toolkit to say it or do it in the way that they need to hear it and experience it in order for them to be persuaded by you. So, the key here is to try and get strong in all four approaches, not just, most of us are strong in two of the four, and we mostly have a weakness in two of the four. So if you keep leaving those things as your weakness, then it means that every time those skills were required to persuade someone, you just don't have what it takes. And as Paul is saying, the opposite of persuasion is not necessarily neutral. When you know, you say whatever you want to say and they listen or not and then they leave and everyone just gets on with it. In Paul's situation, in his body corporate situation, if he fails in the persuasive moment, then it's not a neutral outcome. The people he's trying to persuade might lose money. They might be just confused and find it difficult to make a decision. They might be disappointed in him and not be happy with his services. They might even lose complete respect for him in the moment, which, of course, Paul, is not what I wish for you. So it really is about learning what are the activities that and the actions that these four persuasive types are all good at, and then trying to pull as many of them in to your toolkit so that you don't have those head against the brick wall moments.
You understand what you're saying. It's an extremely difficult situation. But, for example, looking at needs and wants.
I love that, by the way.
They may want, for example, to make a building really pretty. I've got this situation on my hand at the moment, and therefore we need to upgrade the function room. We should have a gymnasium and that. I will come in as the building manager and say, that's what you may want. But right now I've got technical reports on my hand saying I've got really serious problems in, say, two other areas. It might be windows. It might be the plumbing system. And these are the priority for the buildings. Now, of course, you're talking about people that are arguing over quite considerable amounts of money, and emotions become very high. But you've got then the clash between what I'm suggesting and maybe the majority of the committee is suggesting, this is what we need to do, as opposed to those who say, no, but this is what we want to do.
That's it. I hear you. And really, it's about trying to get into those people's shoes, even if at the time you're judging that perhaps their emotional intelligence is a bit lower than you would hope, getting into their shoes and working out what is the approach that's going to convince these stakeholders to fix the technical issues and not put in a gym.
Well, look, thank you very much. I'll have to read your books.
Thanks, Paul. Good on you.
Thank you.
How do you deal with that? How do you deal with just flat-out ignorance? In other words, how do you deal with people who, I mean, maybe all of us have been in meetings like this, that they haven't read the documents, the papers, you know, they haven't read the business papers or the agenda or the report that they're supposed to. I mean, they've got a belief which they've never changed, you know, and they're just flat out ignorant. I mean, some that you do meet people occasionally.
Of course you do. This. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's not because they're not caring to inform themselves.
No.
So how do you deal with that?
No. Well, I even see this at board level because I'm working at the executive level and they don't read their board papers before the board meeting. That I think the principle here is what are they thinking, feeling and doing when I walk into the meeting? What do I want them to be thinking, feeling and doing at the end? There's nothing I can do to force them to read the paper in advance if they don't have time or they can't read the paper in advance and they're ill-informed. So that means I have to start back at first principles and I need to communicate my message in a clear, logical, rational way so that I'm bringing them from where they are to where I need them to be.
Fred from Fremantle. G'day, Fred.
Hello to your guest and.
Yep. Hi.
Hi, Fred.
Hi. What's your name?
Michelle.
Michelle. What did you want to say, Fred?
Michelle. Well, I started a business with five people, and I was pretty much to be the boss, but the my 2IC was not really doing their weight, carrying their weight, but I knew they were the best. But they were sort of deliberately not carrying their weight. It was kind of a weird situation. So what I did was I suggested that they become the boss, and I took the 2IC job, and the business went very well. I sort of did I bluffed him into. I even think this person was going to do it deliberately. Can you get what I'm saying?
Yeah. How long did you step down for Fred? How long did you step down for?
Oh well, we pretty much pulled the same money out of the business, but okay. I wanted him on the team, but he had this egotistical situation where he had to be the boss. So I said, well, if that's the case, you can be the boss.
That's an interesting point though, Michelle. Is that a kind of passive aggressive move? So I'm not saying of you, Fred, but
No, I'm just happy for Fred that his business is successful now.
Of course.
That sounds like a leadership issue to me, not persuasion.
Is there a case for sometimes of saying, well, look, let's do it your way? As a means of persuading people, as a means of showing people that if we do it this way, it's not going to work.
And in the end, everyone got what they wanted, right? Mm. The other guy's the boss. Fred's happy. He's making a lot of money. He doesn't care too much about the position, clearly. Mm. So, Fred, it sounds like a win-win all around. Good on you.
1-300-800-222 is the number. Malcolm from Winmalee. G'day, Malcolm.
G'day, Phil. G'day, Michelle.
Hi.
I was ringing to ask where high-level conflict resolution.
Hello, your phone's a bit wobbly there, Malcolm.
Is that any better?
That's a bit better, yeah. Start again.
Yeah, I was ringing to find out exactly where high-level conflict resolution
in the arts. Yeah, it's a great question, actually. So all four approaches need you to have some sort of a formula when you're managing conflict. And there is a particular formula that I think is the winning formula. And it's got five steps and you just follow the five steps. And at the end, more or less, the other person agrees with you because you, step one, get into their shoes and reflect to them what you appreciate they're worried about, and then you solve what they're worried about, not what you want to say. So, yes, you've hit the nail on the head there. It's persuasion has often a high level of conflict resolution in it because you don't want the other person to walk away feeling that there was conflict, or if there was, that it was resolved in an amicable and functional way.
Yeah, true that. I used to do it for a major electronics company, and they used to get me to handle the screamers. So. I think it also helped that I had a background of being a sergeant in the Army, but yeah.
So was it the sergeant in the Army that you did, or was it more the ability to build rapport and a connection and a friendliness with people that got them to agree with you?
One of the major skills, though, is you had to listen. If you didn't listen, didn't hear what they actually had to say.
Yeah, that's it.
Identify with that.
That's
it. We're never going to resolve the issue.
But Malcolm, can I ask you that was probably, I mean, people think, oh, well, you know, a sergeant in the Army, that all you do is bark orders all the time. But I bet you it wasn't like that, was it?
Well, it depends on the leadership style you use. There's many different types. Mine, to get the best out of my men, was a participatory type of leadership, because I had to use their creativity, their even some of the knowledges that I had outside the system. To get the best work performance out of them. So, yeah, it's again, I mean, you can be the totalitarian if you really wish to. And a lot of people who get newly promoted tend to let that power go to their head. But, yes, it's, again, what you're trying to achieve as a team. I'm very much team orientated in a lot of respects, especially loyal to the employer who employs me. But, yeah, it's, you've got to listen.
Sure.
You don't listen, you don't hear what they have to say, you're going to miss the mark.
Thanks, Mark.
That traditional sort of command and control that you might associate with the military, whether that's correct or not, is what I would call forcing and directing, which is that aggressive approach to influence, and it's not persuasion.
1300 800 222 is the number. Sarah from Bombardieri. G'day, Sarah.
G'day, Phil. G'day to your guest, whose name's escaped me.
Michelle.
So I'm not paying attention. Sorry,
Michelle's Michelle. Her name. Michelle Bowden.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm absolutely lapping up this conversation. I find it absolutely fascinating.
Gorgeous.
And as somebody with lived experience of disability, I find that throughout all my teen and adult life, and I'm now in my early 50s, it has revolved when I want to make really big changes and make headway in bringing other along for the journey and convincing people around me that the impossible that they consider to be impossible is actually possible, because what people will do is project their own suppositions, their own prejudices, their own predispositions, and their own assumptions and perceptions upon, well, if I had blah, 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 disability or, you know, lived experience that I couldn't possibly do, blah, 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 blah. So what you need to do when you walk into a room for an interview or to do a interview, is to remember that this is probably the first time that that individual has had close quarters contact in a meaningful way with somebody who is abled in a different way than they are. So you've got to bring them along for the journey. So you're not just there interviewing against nine other, you know, mugs all up for the same job as you are. You've got to push that a little bit harder. In fact, you've got to push a lot harder, because you've got to bring them along for the ride and turn them around and bring them along for the journey and put in those extra steps, such as give me an hour of your time at no cost to yourself, allow me to come into your workplace and I will show you what I can do.
That's what a commanding eagle would do. Commanding eagles are very credible, and they're really good at conveying their credibility to others. So they seek out opportunities to become more and more competent in their work, which is what you've just described there.
And
beautiful.
And on top of that, ask questions. No questions asked in good faith are off the board.
That's it.
And make sure that people know that there is that the space is safe, that there's no silly question, and that they won't step on a landmine inadvertently. And bring them along for the journey.
Good on you, Sarah. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye. 1300 800 222 my texter says, I work in pharmacy. With the current shortages, we often have generic medications. I've seen people refuse to take generics, even though they're important pain relief or cardiac or diabetes meds. How can you convince someone that their perceptions like this are actually wrong and dangerous? I mean, I'm 6 years of uni to be a pharmacist, but they know better. Well, I can feel this.
It's such a good point, isn't it?
You know, I want the brand name, the brand name med, because, you know, that's what I want.
Yeah.
Even though the generic is exactly the same.
So isn't that interesting? Is it because the consumer believed what their doctor said and the doctor said, get this name, and they just want to follow what the doctor said? So in that way, they see the doctor as the credible authority and not the pharmacist.
Do you reckon that's what's going on?
We're all hallucinating, aren't we? Is it that they don't trust the pharmacist because they don't have a relationship with that person? And so when they're suggesting a generic's fine, they can't really tell if the pharmacist is just trying to sell them a product so that they can make money from a customer, or whether they've got the person's best interests at heart. So that's back to the friendly budgie.
Mm.
Is it maybe that they're not giving enough data in the short, very short conversation they'd be having with someone in that context, enough data to prove that a generic is exactly the same as the brand name product?
Hmm.
Yeah. So it depends on what is the person's, what approach is most necessary for that person in order for them to be persuaded. You're the pharmacist. You don't need to be persuaded. You're not trying to persuade yourself. You're trying to persuade them, so you've got to do whatever is the approach that they need.
Yeah, so you would say in that instance that you have to try and suss out who you're dealing with here.
Yeah, that's why we came up with these birds, because it's...
And use one of these approaches depending on who you're talking to.
Or all of them in one conversation as quickly and cleverly as you can, you know, pulling out the leaflet that comes in the box and showing all of the proof that it's exactly the same active ingredients, and then explaining about how all the other people that they know have in the area having this medicine and the fact that they went to pharmacy school and they've learned about the way these medicines interact and that this is absolutely the same thing. You know, you've got to try and find a way of getting it all into the one conversation, which is very hard when it's only, you know, a minute of talking.
Yeah.
Really hard.
Exactly. What are the big mistakes you think people make when they're trying to persuade people?
The main mistake is that we forget to ask the person for exactly what we want.
Right.
We go into a persuasive conversation and we assume that they've read our minds and worked it out. You have to state clearly and bluntly exactly what you are asking the person to agree with so that they know what they're saying yes or no to.
So give us
in Australia, we're terrible at this.
Give me an example of that.
Well, the pharmacy example, saying to the customer, you can feel 100% confident that this product is exactly the same, and if you buy this medicine, it will give you the same results that the brand name would give you. You can feel confident purchasing this product.
Mm.
Be super clear.
So that's the proposition you're putting to them.
Yeah. So then they can say, well, no, I won't.
I won't because I want the brand name product.
That's it. The example at work with a pitch, I'm selling a product or a service. Australians are so terrible at saying to the client, I really would love to work with you. Please choose me. Or this product is the best product on the market. Please choose to purchase it. Let's buy in bulk. We're just really bad at asking for the thing that we want, and people can't read our minds.
Hmm. Yeah.
I think that's the main mistake.
Okay.
There's about 15 mistakes, though.
Listening's always big, isn't it? Listening's
yeah.
always big. And too much talking, because sometimes you think, oh, well, you know, with successful salespeople, they just talk you into it in the end. Do they?
I don't think they do, actually. I think that many people would think that, actually.
Because they won't shut up. They just talk and talk until eventually you say, okay, all right, fine.
And it's what I call the dogged offence approach, where you just wear them down.
Mm.
There's something else that we've researched in our business is something called the predisposition to persuade, which is essentially your care factor when it comes to persuading the people around you. Some people are really driven to change people's minds, and they do typically do well in sales. And then there are people who have absolutely no interest whatsoever in changing your mind. So you might have a conversation about climate change or something and you completely disagree and they couldn't care less what you think. You can just think what you want and good luck to you.
I profoundly believe that, I must say. I mean, I admire sales skills a lot because, you know, people who are really good at selling things are rare, actually. People who are really good at selling things. And I think it is almost a vocation. They're born to it.
Yeah, they're born to it.
They enjoy the cut and thrust of it.
That's it.
They enjoy the game.
They have a high predisposition to persuade. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they'll always be the most persuasive person in the room. So to your point about if you talk a lot, will you be the most persuasive? I'm sure your listeners can think about that dinner party where you had the really noisy friend that just kept saying to people, what you've got to understand is this. And no, listen to me. And then there's someone else who's like a wizard. They barely say anything. They sit quietly and they enjoy the conversation. And then when they do speak up, you could hear a pin drop. And everyone leans in and they listen to the wise person who's got their five words to say at the dinner party, and everyone's just in complete agreement. So sometimes it is that quieter person who hasn't had a lot to say that in the end cuts through with their opinion, whereas sometimes in a social situation at least, the noisy one, we sometimes laugh at that friend, don't we? It's like, off they go again. Oh, Fred, you know. Yeah.
Thane from Marrickville. Hi, Thane.
Yes, good evening.
Hi.
Made me think about a long time working in theatre I was a carpenter building sets.
Right.
Building the theatre sets. And once a week we had a production meeting with all the artistics, the director, the set designer, and so on. And they used to keep saying, well, we've got 2 weeks. Can't we just make it larger and add another story to the set and do this or do that? And I had three responses, and they were written on little bits of paper. One was time. Can we just put opening night off for a couple of weeks?
Mm.
The other one was money, and the third one was safety.
Mm.
And that was quite persuasive because there was the big boss who had the budget sitting at the end of the table, and he would go, all right, he's making sense. And the poor old artistic chap had to maybe scale back his desires, you know.
Yeah, that's interesting. Thane raised an interesting point here, though, which I wanted to ask you about, Michelle, too. That is, in the end, is what you're talking about, is this kind of persuasion ultimately saying many times we simply have to compromise? Because, you see, there'll be people who will say that's the problem, that compromise often leads us down the wrong path. You know, there are things we shouldn't compromise on, for example. I mean, there is a better way to do this and we shouldn't really compromise on it, and that if we're simply accommodating everyone's views and listening to everyone and trying to add a bit of everyone's view into the decision, we're getting the horse designed by a committee which ends up looking like a camel.
Yeah, that's it. I completely agree with you. And there are some decisions, there's some arguments we shouldn't win. And sometimes we do need to compromise because it's just not reasonable to expect the other party to do what we first wanted. And if your intent is right, if you care about the other person's needs as much as you do about your own, then it's unlikely you'll feel that you were the one that was manipulated in the end into the wrong decision.
Mm.
Yeah, I do think you could call it compromise. It's sort of moved into the area of negotiation skills when you start talking about compromise. And there's this thing in negotiation called the best alternative. And so you might say, with the theatre example, that the artistic director wants it to be two stories higher and painted in an expensive gold paint, the best alternative is, well, we have only one story and we don't paint it gold, we paint it light brown instead. So that is a compromise.
But it may not end up pleasing anybody.
It's the best alternative that you're happy to accept.
Janet from Clovelly. Hi, Janet.
Oh, hi, Phil, and hello, Michelle.
Hi.
Well, thanks. Hi, lovely to hear this. I think it's one of the most interesting conversations we've had. You know, there was always good stuff, but this is really interesting to me because I'm on a couple of boards and committees, Michelle, and I wonder, you said there were four types of persuasion. I wasn't, I'm not sure that, I must have missed maybe a couple of them, but I wonder, Michelle, do we change our, I think that we change our language when we say we're sitting on a board and we're aiming to persuade professional people of different types, you know, to a certain point of view, versus perhaps a more social and familial persuasion, you know, when we're in family, when we're in more a social situation or more when we're trying to sort of go into a family situation. Do you think we change our language? I think we do. I think we're more professional and then we've come down a notch. Or...
That's absolutely the case. And my research is in corporate, so it's mostly to do with work persuasion, like your board situation and what it is that we need to do to be successful in that arena. And then just by fluke, some of the skills and actions also work when you're at home. But I think if your actual type won't change, but the way you behave within the type will change if you're in a social situation rather than a work one, if you know what I mean.
Yes. I do. I just think that when I'm at my board meeting, my language changes quite a lot. I tend to be, you know, more academic and educational and try to point things out in a different way. But if I'm in a social situation, I'm trying to persuade a friend to do something, I find I have to be a little bit more congenial and a little bit more, you know, a little bit more empathetic towards...
And that is someone who is persuasive, right? Who has tried to build the actions into your toolkit and you pull out the right one in the right moment for the right people so that you get more of what you want regardless of the situation. That's exactly why I wrote the book.
Well, thank you, Michelle.
Amazing.
I've got to get that book.
Thanks, Shannon. Bye-bye. Yeah. We've all met the person in a meeting who reels off great reams of facts, haven't we? Reams and reams of stats.
It's dreadful PowerPoint slides.
Yeah, or just someone who just seems to have, you know, you see this in politics a lot too. People just reel off endless stats, you know. Spending's up 30% this year and 60%, blah, 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 blah. You've no idea whether any of this is true or not. There's no way of quickly checking any of this.
Correct.
This is almost always a wrong way to persuade people, isn't it?
Unless you're a wise owl. So why other wise owls are absolutely persuaded by a data dump like that.
Yeah.
They love the busy slides in a business meeting. They love it when someone gives you the 60% up and the 30% down and they don't typically need to check it.
Right,
they just are inspired
Yeah. Just to sum up here as a takeaway, though, you would say that the key thing is to start off, if you're trying to persuade people, is to start off getting everyone, in a sense, to agree on what they're trying to achieve here, what they want. What's the goal here?
What's the goal? When it comes to persuading someone else, step one is to know what is your approach to persuasion, what comes naturally to you. Step two is to work out what does the other person need from you, so just in case it's different. Step three is to, if you don't have the skills to persuade the other person, build them. It's just going to be a few actions that you need to turn into habits that make you a bit more persuasive with that style of person. And then make sure you do flex or adapt your approach to give the person what they need if they are to be persuaded by you. And none of that's worth anything if you're not clear in the first place on what you're trying to achieve. What is the thing you're trying to persuade about? So, yes, I think you're right. It's about your goal in the moment.
We need a better common room in the public areas. That's our goal. How to get there? All right. Look, interesting. And there's I think all of us have been in the situations we've described tonight. I hope we got something out of it. Michelle, it's terrific to talk with you. Michelle Bowden has been with us, the author of How to Persuade: The Skills You Need to Get What You Want. Michelle, thanks for joining us.
What a pleasure.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.